All right. Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Sunday, May 15th, 2016, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. My name is Russ Belville. I'm with CannabisRadio.com. I host the live daily talk radio program, The Russ Belville Show, which is the NPR of POT. We are news, analysis, information, opinion, interviews, and more. And today my presentation is entitled, "It's Not About Marijuana, It's About Freedom." And the idea here is marijuana prohibition is not only unconstitutional, but it also affects almost all of our civil liberties. CannabisRadio.com is available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and Stitcher. We've got a lot of great programs out there for growers, for enthusiasts, for activists, reformers, researchers. Tommy Chong's got a program on Cannabis Radio. And of course, my program, The Russ Belville Show, is heard live every weekday at 2 o'clock Alaska time, I should say. You can pick it up online live, or you can listen to it as a podcast through iTunes. And we give you the latest news and information, give you the latest interviews, and I travel all across the country giving you kind of the flavor of what's going on in legalization. So what I'd like to start with is the idea that marijuana prohibition itself is fundamentally un-American. There is no legitimate reason why our government should be banning marijuana in any form whatsoever, especially if you take a look back at history and you take a look at our Enlightenment era founding fathers. This was an era when they were championing reason and logic above emotion and tradition. So it's not just unconstitutional for us to be banning marijuana use by adults. It contravenes our natural rights. The natural rights that our Constitution recognizes were endowed not by a king, not by a legislature, but by our Creator. In our Declaration, we state, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Self-evident. They need no defense. They need no proof. These truths are self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And a right being unalienable means that no government, no law, no legislature can repeal that right. It is an inherent right in the people, in the citizens. That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Note the phrase, "among these." These three aren't the only ones that are unalienable. These are just the first three that we mentioned. But there are plenty of other unalienable natural rights. And notice also that it's the pursuit of happiness. There's not a right to happiness. You merely, as a citizen, as an adult, have the right to pursue happiness as you see fit. So, among these rights, could the right to cannabis be one of those unalienable rights? And I'm going to make the argument that indeed it is. The right to cannabis in America for American adults is an unalienable right. First of all, take into account that our founders were a bunch of hemp farmers. The foundation of our colonies in the early 1600s was preceded by the English Navy defeating the Spanish Armada in 1588, and there was tens of thousands of acres of hemp being used on those ships for rigging and for sails. So the American people were founded by and dependent on this industrial hemp. In 1632, the Virginia Assembly ordered, quote, that every planter, as soon as he may, provide seed of flax and hemp and sow the same. So the first colonies in the very beginning of this country were being ordered to grow hemp. Virginians at the time, the Virginia colony, could pay their taxes with hemp as well as other cash crops. And finally, the British Parliament, even we were still being ruled by the British, was providing bounties for hemp growing. So they were promoting the growing of hemp in the colonies to help the British Navy, to help all of the needs there for Britain. Got a nice lithograph there of George Washington overseeing his slaves at Mount Vernon. So much for the all men are created equal part. However, when we look back at that early founding fathers era, a lot of times people in the marijuana movement will try to take some quotes to determine that the founding fathers had actually consumed cannabis like we do, you know, by smoking it for mind-altering purposes. Now, at the time of the founding of this country, it was well known that there were psychoactive effects from hemp. It goes back to the Greeks burning hemp seed and the Chinese using it as medicine. But it really wasn't used that way in the early colonial times, for which we can find verifiable records. At the time, hemp was far more valuable. It was far more valuable to grow hemp than to try to take the time to grow cannabis for the use of medicine or psychoactive purposes. Besides, they had access to opium in those times. So when they needed a painkiller, they had, you know, much greater ammo, so to speak. And we don't find any colonial era references to marijuana or hashish use in the colonies. We do find some when they talk about France, when they talk about Europe. It was kind of a hashish vogue that happened in the late 1700s, but not so much in the colonies. And maybe that owes to the fact it was kind of a hard scrabble life in the colonies, not a lot of time for luxury and enjoying hemp in that way. But it's not that our founding fathers weren't partiers. These guys were heavy duty partiers. This is an engraving of Washington's farewell to his officers. It was describing the evening of September 14th, 1787. And these guys were into cider and ale and wine, and they were heavy duty partiers. The bar tab for Washington's farewell address, 55 guys at the party, came to over 15,000 of today's dollars. It included 54 bottles of Madeira, 60 bottles of claret, 8 bottles of Old Stock, 22 bottles of porter, 8 bottles of cider, 12 kegs of beer, 7 large bowls of punch, and then for the musicians, another 16 bottles of claret, 5 bottles of Madeira, and 7 bowls of punch. And this is in our founding records. You can find this in the Library of Congress. So you run up a $15,000 bar tab trying to start a country. It kind of suggests to me that these guys had this idea that it was okay to get yourself altered. It was okay to have fun as an adult. So, does the fact that we have hard-drinking hemp farming founding fathers, does that mean we have a right to use cannabis? Natural right. Well, let's take a look at some of the other declarations of rights that existed back in the early 1700s. There was a right to consciousness that was defined in the Virginia Declaration of Rights that said, quote, "Religion, or the duty which we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it, can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence, and therefore all men are entitled to the free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience." And this is interesting. In the founding of our country, there were a segment of them that were very religious men, but there were another segment of them that were kind of deists, which was an idea that God was a clockmaker. He makes the clock, but once the clock's running, it kind of runs, and he doesn't interfere. So there was a lot of fight over the use of the words religion and God, and the founding fathers actually dictated down to creator or to the word creator to try to avoid some of those entanglements. I believe this focus on reason and conviction and conscience, though, tells us the mindset of the founders was that we have the right to our own minds. We have the right to our own consciousness. And in the Boston 1772 right of property, among the natural rights of colonists are first, a right to life, second, a right to liberty, thirdly, the right to property. So we've got hemp farmers who believe there's a right to property and a right to free conscience. And that while the colonies regulated alcohol, they did not ban alcohol. Taverns were the meeting places where our revolutionaries met to be able to form these colonies and form this country. And the excise taxes on alcohol were the first taxes that helped fund the United States of America. So it seems to me that the hard-drinking hemp farming founders would think we probably have a right to grow cannabis. I mean, they knew it had a psychoactive effect. And while they didn't really use it that way, they didn't ban it either. They believed in a freedom of conscience, and they altered their consciousness with alcohol quite a bit. And of course, that part about the pursuit of happiness. I mean, come on. What else would we need to prove that we have the right to cannabis? But as American history unfolds, we take kind of a dark turn. The story of how we managed to go from a bunch of hard-drinking hemp farmers to a country that in the 1900s banned alcohol shows just how much the politics can change and just how much stereotyping and fear-mongering can lead that change. What we saw with alcohol is a lot what we saw with cannabis as well. And I'll make these parallels for you. The beginnings of American temperance start in the mid-1700s. John Adams, who had become president, noted that taverns had become the eternal haunt of loose and disorderly people. And, interestingly enough, he called them the nurseries of our legislators. He made the point that since all the early colonial times they gathered in taverns to make political decisions, some of the early legislators realized, hey, if there were more taverns, and I was like drinking buddies with all these guys in all these taverns, I could get political office. So that's what he was referring to as the nurseries of our legislators, that the early elected officials would go get people drunk to get their votes. The religious people start to take an attack on this in the late 1700s. The Methodists are the first to take a stand against liquor, and then it becomes a movement for other Protestant organizations, Presbyterians, Universalists, Baptists, and so on. We still were having, you know, westward expansion in territories. My home state of Oregon, when it was the Oregon Territory, was the first to enact alcohol prohibition in 1843. They got rid of it 5 years later. Only took Oregon 5 years to figure out that nobody really wanted alcohol prohibition. The first actual state to prohibit it was Maine in 1847. And then that was followed up by Ohio, Illinois, Rhode Island, Minnesota, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and New York. But all of these got repealed or vetoed, or their state courts decided they were unconstitutional. So what this establishes for us is that up until the 1900s, the U.S. government did not believe it had the right to be able to ban anything, to be able to ban alcohol or anything. It was left to the states. And then even a lot of those states didn't feel there was a right to ban alcohol because it got overturned or it got vetoed. But by the 1900s, we start to get this temperance movement, the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Anti-Saloon League. And it was interesting because at the time there was that fight for women's suffrage too, give women the right to vote. And they kind of worked together. Women were kind of upset that their men were off to the taverns all the time, getting drunk on cider and ale and stumbling across the streets and abandoning their families. So combined with women beginning to get the right to vote, they started voting for these anti-alcohol laws to get their men back out of the taverns. So it was an interesting gender dynamic that was going on at the time too. So that led to national alcohol prohibition. I love this picture from Prohibition. This is one of the women's groups that said, "Lips that touch liquor shall not touch ours." It's like the old Greek Lysistrata, right? They won't give it up if you're going to be drinking. But what's interesting about that is that, again, the United States government did not believe it had the right to ban alcohol. They had to do a constitutional amendment to ban alcohol. You just couldn't ban it. You had to change the whole Constitution. It's also interesting about alcohol prohibition is that it's not like what we think of as marijuana prohibition today. Alcohol prohibition is really like what more we call marijuana decriminalization today. Because under alcohol prohibition, you couldn't make it, you couldn't distribute it, you couldn't sell it, but it was okay to possess it. If in 1918 you filled your cellar full of alcohol bottles, by 1920 it was still legal to have those. If you had a big enough stash, you could last all the way through Prohibition. There was no law against having alcohol or drinking alcohol. It was just making it, selling it, and transporting it. And in fact, there was even medicinal alcohol. Just like we have medical marijuana, they had medicinal alcohol back in the day. You could get a guy to write you a script, and you could buy bottles of medicinal alcohol. One of the guys who had the federal license to sell those medical alcohol scripts was a guy named Walgreen. Does that name sound familiar? The Walgreens pharmacy chain became famous and wealthy through selling medical alcohol. Interesting little statistic there. Now, of course, alcohol prohibition only lasted 13 years because everybody realized all it did was create a whole bunch of crime and violence and didn't stop the alcohol at all. There was still plenty of alcohol coming into the country. So the way that alcohol prohibition fell was a lot like how marijuana prohibition's falling. It fell at the state level first. New York was one of the first states that said, we're just not going to enforce it anymore. Y'all want to send the feds in here to take care of it, go ahead, but we're not going to waste New York State taxpayer money busting people for booze. Washington State was another early state that just repealed or didn't pay any attention to the alcohol prohibition. So by 1933, we get the 21st Amendment. It repeals alcohol prohibition. And interestingly enough, it inserts the word intoxicating into our Constitution by saying the law against intoxicating liquors is repealed. So now we have even more evidence that there's some constitutionality to this idea of getting intoxicated, this idea of changing our minds, our altering our moods. But just because alcohol prohibition ended in 1933, didn't mean that all the states were suddenly legal. Every state still had its own laws, and in fact, Mississippi was a dry state until 1966. They were still prohibition for 33 more years after that, and to this day, there are still dry counties. Oklahoma, Texas, bunches of places. Here in Alaska, there's places you can't get alcohol because it's still banned at the local level. That furthermore tells me there's no federal right for this marijuana prohibition. Alcohol is something that messes us up, and yet it has to be handled at the state and local level. Marijuana should be the same. So now let's take a look at how we got to marijuana prohibition, because remember, up to this time, the federal government doesn't think it has the right to do that. They had to come up with a constitutional amendment to ban alcohol, so how did they get around banning marijuana? This is something I like to call a confluence of opportunities and racism. There can be no denying the foundation of the war on drugs is racism. There's other reasons, we'll get to them, but it's strongly racism. Because the laws that make marijuana illegal are part of what we call the Controlled Substances Act, but you know, it's not the substances that get the gun pointed at them. It's not the substances that get locked up with their hands behind their back and a free ride in a cop car, it's the people. Never forget, this is a war on people. And that's where my talk hinges, is that we're talking about people, not plants. They happen to use plants, but they're people. So here's how this began. The first anti-marijuana laws were passed in 1909 in El Paso, Texas, to deal with the Mexican problem. It's a lot of like what we hear from Donald Trump today. Oh, the Mexicans are coming to steal our jobs. Like, you're going to go pick strawberries, Donald Trump. Give me a break. But anyway, El Paso was the first one to pass it. And again, it was about criminalizing brown people. And because the law says you can't just say someone's illegal because they're brown, but you can make what they smoke illegal, and then they can be busted. And keep this in mind, these anti-marijuana laws that started were against the smoking of what they called at the time loco weed. They didn't ban the cannabis tinctures that you could get at the drugstore that the white folks were using. Those were fine. It was the smoking of the weed by the brown folks that was the problem. More states followed El Paso, Texas. States started passing marijuana prohibition laws, especially the southwestern states near the Mexican border. And also, this is starting to happen. The states are starting to ramp up their prohibition in the late 20s and early 30s. The same time, alcohol prohibition is ending by the early 30s. Well, you have this big government bureaucracy. You remember Elliot Ness and the Untouchables, all these federal cops who now don't have anything to do. They've got this whole organization built up of federal cops with nothing to do. And that's when this guy named Harry J. Anslinger enters the picture. Harry J. Anslinger is the first head of what they called the new Federal Bureau of Narcotics. His brilliant idea is we could take all these old prohibition cops and move them over to this marijuana problem, this narcotics problem, and we'd all still have jobs. And it's still a jobs program, folks. They're still manufacturing jobs off this prohibition. By 1937, all 48 of the states that existed by that time had already passed their own marijuana prohibition at the state level. So it was illegal everywhere. So why did the feds need to get in at that point? Well, because they're feds, and so they did. And what they did, they had to keep Harry J. Anslinger and the federal cops in business, so they made a federal law that was called the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. And they got the old spelling with the H, Marijuana Tax Act. So the Marijuana Tax Act was interesting because, again, at this point, the government does not believe it has the right to ban things. And so it doesn't. The Marijuana Tax Act does not ban marijuana. It says it's illegal to have marijuana without your tax stamp. You got to pay the taxes on it. And then they just didn't give out tax stamps. Okay, so you can't get a tax stamp. You got marijuana, boom, it's illegal, not because of the pot, but because of the taxes. And that's how they brought down Al Capone, too, was taxes, right? So the government still at this point is recognizing they have no authority to ban marijuana. They have to use this loophole of taxation to get around to it. Now, this ban on marijuana was also backed up by the mainstream media. The mainstream media was also trying to help out some of the other industries at the time, timber, oil, and those that were threatened by hemp. But the engine that made this happen was rank racism and fear-mongering. Here's a quote from Newsweek of 1937. A California man decapitated his best friend while under the spell of the smoke. That's Newsweek saying people chop people's heads off if they're high. Whew, better be careful with the cannabis club tonight. Scientific American saying marijuana produces a wide variety of symptoms in the user, including hilarity, swooning, and sexual excitement. It often makes the smoker vicious, with a desire to fight and kill. Man, that's some bad weed. I don't know what kind of weed they're smoking in 1936. I'd never smoked anything that made me want to fight and kill someone. Alcohol? Yeah, I've had some. Tequila, I've had some of that. And here, the New York Times, 1933. Marijuana is highly intoxicating and constitutes an ever-recurring problem where there are Mexicans or Spanish Americans of the lower classes. That's like New York Times. That's legit news gathering rank racism. And William Randolph Hearst himself, in one of his newspapers, I think it was San Francisco Chronicle, marijuana influences Negroes to look at white people in the eye, step on white men's shadows, and look at a white woman twice. Wow. This is America, folks. And there's people still alive when that stuff was coming out, right? But the king of marijuana racism and prohibition, the absolute worst guy in our history, is this guy, Harry J. Anslinger. Harry J. Anslinger, that head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, was in charge of that job from 1937 to 1962, FDR to JFK. 25 years, this man set the tone for marijuana, and here's the tone he set. The primary reason to outlaw marijuana is its effect on the degenerate races. Marijuana is taken by musicians, and I'm not speaking about good musicians, but the jazz type. He really hated jazz, by the way. What he hated about jazz was all the jazz musicians, the blacks, were getting white people to come and listen to jazz. Uh-oh, mixing. And he actually hunted Billie Holiday down to her death, handcuffed her to her bed going through a heroin overdose, and watched her die. This is not a nice man. And his other quote, there are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers. Their satanic music, jazz, and swing result from marijuana use. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others. Wow. Of course, a lot of good it did. Now there are 28 million marijuana smokers. So, not a lot of good he did. But yeah, this is the guy setting the tone. This is where the racism of the marijuana war is set, decade after decade, from the top federal enforcer of drugs, that's your guy, Harry Anslinger. But as we get to the late 60s, a miracle occurs. How many people remember Timothy Leary? Timothy Leary was the so-called acid guru of the 60s. He was a Harvard PhD psychiatric professor who, his famous phrase was, tune in, turn on, drop out. He was leading a whole generation of kids into flower power and psychedelics and LSD and mescaline and all this crazy stuff. And he was a brilliant man. And he sued the federal government over the Marijuana Tax Act because he said, look, you can't have marijuana without a tax stamp. To get the stamp, I have to bring the marijuana in to get it weighed. The minute I bring that marijuana in that doesn't have a stamp in it, I'm breaking the law, so what you're making me do is incriminate myself to follow the law, and that breaks the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. And the Supreme Court, in a 9-0 unanimous decision, said, yep, Dr. Leary, you're absolutely right. The federal government has no right to ban cannabis. Not with the Tax Act, at least. Not by forcing someone to break a law to follow a law. That's against the Fifth Amendment. So for a brief time, from the 1960s, when that decision, 1969, when that decision happened, to 1971, when Congress passed the Controlled Substance Act, marijuana was not federally illegal. Still illegal at the state level in every state, so it didn't change much. People were still getting busted. But for a brief window there, it was federally legal. Well, we couldn't have that, could we? This is where Tricky Dick Nixon comes in. Some of us are old enough to remember Tricky Dick Nixon. Although I was just a kid, he's one of my first political memories. I remember him on the helicopter. Oh, that guy. He's out of there. So Nixon gets Congress to pass what's called the Controlled Substances Act of 1971. And this is what's still affecting us today. It creates five schedules for drugs. And these drugs end up in five schedules. The bottom four, two through five, are all drugs with medical accepted use, but you got to get a prescription. There's a lot of rules. Schedule one is the only one that says it's no medical use whatsoever, no safe use under a doctor's supervision, and a high potential for abuse. You know, like heroin, LSD, and PCP. So that's where marijuana got put in 1971 with absolutely no scientific basis whatsoever, right? Just Nixon wanted it there, and so that's where it got put. Now, the Controlled Substances Act is the federal government saying that something is banned. And up to this point, we've been telling you that previously in history, it was not accepted that this was possible, that there was no constitutional right for the federal government to ban things. But during World War II, a loophole was created. It's a court decision called Wickard v. Filburn, and it had to do with wheat. We'll come back to Wickard v. Filburn, but keep that in mind that there was a trick that was employed to get this Controlled Substances Act to work. So Nixon, by the way, hated weed. Nixon hated weed, but he didn't really hate the weed so much as he hated the people that smoked the weed, and that was the blacks and the hippies. The blacks and the hippies. We're talking late 60s, early 70s, anti-Vietnam War protesting. Black power movements are starting. Civil rights has just been passed. Voting Rights Act has passed. Turbulent time in American history. So Nixon decides he's going to put together a commission, a blue ribbon commission headed by a former Republican governor named Raymond P. Schaefer. And we're going to get scientific backing so that when we put this Controlled Substances Act together, we can ban marijuana. And when we got some backing, right? We got science. So here's a couple of statements from Nixon from the Nixon White House tapes. This was recorded by Richard Nixon as they were discussing the lead up to this report. He says, quote, "I want a goddamn strong statement on marijuana. I mean one on marijuana that just tears the ass out of them. You know, it's a funny thing. Every one of the bastards out there for legalizing marijuana is Jewish. What the Christ is the matter with the Jews, Bob? What is the matter with them?" And, "You see, homosexuality, dope, immorality in general, these are the enemies of strong societies. That's why the communists and the left-wingers are pushing this stuff. They're trying to destroy us." So Nixon wanted to fight weed here because of the people that were using it, his perceptions as to what the left-wing movement was all about. And this is something that we as drug reformers have been saying for years. We've said for years that the war on drugs was all about criminalizing blacks and hippies. And they said, "Oh, you conspiracy theorists. Oh, you crazy pot smokers. Oh, that's just a conspiracy." Well, guess what? We were right. There's an article in Harper's Magazine, cover story, just came out last month, where they talked to this author who interviewed one of Nixon's aides, a guy named John Ehrlichman, who went to jail for the Watergate conspiracy. So he's interviewing Ehrlichman, and this was 6 years ago that he interviewed him. I don't know if it was 6 years, but years ago he interviewed Ehrlichman, and this is what Ehrlichman said. "The Nixon campaign in 1968, and the Nixon White House after that, had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt their communities, we could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." Bam. Case closed. I mean, absolutely, the war on drugs was created to vilify the anti-war left and the black power movements. Now, this legacy, like I say, from Anslinger from 37 to 62, from Nixon from 1971 all the way through today, we saw it in Reagan, we saw it in the Clinton administration talking about the super predators that need to be brought to heel, that this war on drugs has been all about criminalizing minorities. And a lot of times speakers will talk about this, they'll give you stats. Like the ACLU has shown that black people are four times more likely to get busted for weed, even though we smoke and we toke and sell all at the same rates. But stats, I don't think, really tell the story, because when you talk about stats, sometimes you lose the fact we're talking about people, We're talking about real people's lives and how they're impacted by a marijuana arrest. So I decided to do a little experiment. And I got a little graph here. You ever go to those websites where you can look up mugshots? There's a lot of them online. Mugshots.com, whosarrested.com, a bunch of mugshot websites. So I found a mugshot website that would list what the crime was. Because some of them they don't say, it's just a mugshot, right? Well, this one showed what the crime was. And so I looked up Milwaukee County, Wisconsin. Milwaukee County, Wisconsin. And I looked up their mugshots for possession of less than 25 grams of marijuana. So less than an ounce, right? Personal possession amounts. And this was for 2 months, for the months of January and February 2012. And what I did is I collected all the mugshots I could find and I clipped them out one by one and I put them into separate piles. Here's my white folks, here's my Hispanic folks, and here's my black folks. Now, admittedly, this is not scientific. I might have misplaced a Dominican guy somewhere. I don't know, right? But, you know, generally speaking, this gives you an idea. And so when you look at this, the way this graph works here is that I've given you the populations. Now, this is the population of Wisconsin, the whole state. In the whole state of Wisconsin, 83% of the people who smoke pot monthly are white folks. And about 13% are Hispanic, another 10% are black. But that's the whole state. Wisconsin's kind of a rural state. So let's look at Milwaukee County itself. The population of Milwaukee County is pretty mixed. It's 54% white folks, 19% Hispanic and other, and 27% black. So it's about one black folk, one Latino, and two white folks, if you did the math, right? It's about half and half, right? So if the mugshots are adding up right, and I'll show you, like, let's take 10 mugshots here. If I can get that pointer out of the way. Okay, so we get, there we go. There's 10 white mugshots, okay? So what we're doing is we're going to stack them up over here in the white section. And then we'll get some Latino mugshots, and we'll stack them up over here in the Latino section. There's 10 of them. And then we get 10 black mugshots, and we'll stack them up over here, and they get cut off a little bit, but you can see mostly, right? So if this were accurate, like if this were proportional, there should be white mugshots filling up this part, and Latino mugshots filling up this part, and black mugshots filling up this part. So let's add some more mugshots, right? Except there's a problem. I've only got one more white mugshot. This is 2 months worth of marijuana arrests in Milwaukee County, Wisconsin, and they only got 11 white people. Well, let's add some Latino mugshots. Well, problem there. I've only got 5 more Latino mugshots. 15 Latinos in the span of 2 months busted for weed. Now, we can add 10 more black mugshots and... Ah, hell, let me dispense with the pretending. There's 20, 30, 40, 50... 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, 110, 120, 130, 138. 138 black mugshots in two months. Now, again, this is not science, right? Some people might have gotten their mugshots taken off the site. Some of them might have hired a lawyer and gotten out of those charges. But guess who those people were? White folks getting out of those charges. Every person on that slide is someone who might be trying to get a job someday, who has an employer, who looks up on a mugshot website and sees their face. Every person on that is somebody who might want to go to school someday and has to check a box on a little card that says, I've been convicted of a drug crime, and can't get that student loan that they're looking for. These are real people's lives that are being affected by this, and disproportionately, people of color and young people. So, let's take a look at this in more depth. How does this marijuana prohibition affect our civil liberties, every single one of us? And I argue you would be hard-pressed to find any other issue in American politics that affects so many of your fundamental liberties. But when we talk about civil rights, people tend to think of other subjects. They think of gay rights or you know, black rights or women's rights. We think of those as being civil rights battles. But even in those civil rights battles, there's some clues about our civil rights battle. For example, the right to birth control, controlling your own pregnancy, those are some pretty strong women's rights. But don't those tell us that we have a right to our own bodies? My lungs, my choice. My brain, my choice. How about the laws or the fight for against racism and ethnic discrimination and national origin? Well, doesn't that tell us that we don't discriminate against group of people that have a common culture and background? And the fight for religious freedoms, you know, we can't discriminate against people against what they believe. So you're telling me then, I have a certain right to believe things and act accordingly so long as I don't harm others. My ex-wife came from a family that believes in no doctors. They're one of those, you know, faith healing, pray the illness away. We recognize that as a civil right, but not me smoking a joint. I can't believe that. And the disconnect comes from this. They think they're banning a harmful plant. I think they're oppressing a harmless people. We are a people. I'm a stoner, a pothead, a cannabis consumer, a patient, whatever label you want to put on me, that's me, whether I'm smoking a joint right now or not, whether I got weed on me right now or not, whether I quit for a month or not, I'm still a person who's a part of this community, and this community should not be discriminated against. Again, the founding fathers who wrote our Bill of Rights were a bunch of drunken hemp farmers in a farm economy. How could they not think we had the right to farm, to plant seeds and sow crops? Marijuana prohibition subverts our natural and constitutional rights more so than any other law. Let's run it down. The First Amendment. How does prohibition affect the First Amendment? Well, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. You have the freedom of religion unless you're a Rastafarian. And then you can't smoke your sacramental herb. But Native Americans can use peyote and ayahuasca. Why? Because those aren't that popular. Sorry, Rastafarians, your sacrament is too popular. That makes no sense. We have the right to freedom of speech, freedom of the press, unless you want to advertise your legal pot shop. Then we'll restrict your freedom of the press all we want. In fact, the new law that's going in, was it Massachusetts, I think, or Maine? No, it's Maine. The new law going in Maine says that magazines like High Times and Dope and Marijuana Investor have to go behind the counter like hustlers. They have to have their cover covered and be behind the counter, treating marijuana like porn. So much for our First Amendment. The right of people peaceably to assemble. We have the right to gather together. Unless you can see us smoking pot, then they can bust us. You have the right to petition your government for a redress of grievances, except most states don't have initiative system. We got it here in Alaska. We have it in Oregon. Most of the Western states do. But those folks out in the East, they got to depend on their legislators who are in the pockets of all the industries that don't want to legalize. How about this one? You might know this one in Alaska, right? Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed unless you're a medical marijuana patient on a registry somewhere, because the 1968 Gun Control Act says we cannot sell guns and ammo to a unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance. Also, if you get busted with weed, state and federal marijuana penalties are much more harsh if you're caught with a firearm. Even if it's a legal firearm, even if you got a permit for it, even if it's just a hunting rifle, you can get double the time in some states because you have a gun near your grow. And of course, convicted felons are prohibited from keeping and bearing arms. That should be B-E-A-R, not bearing arms. That's still quite legal. They're convicted felons not allowed to keep and bear arms. And many of these states set their felony penalties at an ounce or less even. So it's really easy to become a felon if you got a little too much weed, and then boom, you lose your gun rights. Funny how I never hear the NRA talking about this, huh? NRA doesn't want to really speak up for the pot smokers, do they? Now, I come from Idaho. I come from a strong gun culture, man, and this is one of the things that really makes me mad. Is you think because I'm smoking weed, I can't have a gun, but the guy with a 12-pack can go out there in the woods and cause a bunch of mayhem? No way, man. No way. How about the Third Amendment? There's a quiz for you. Nobody knows the Third Amendment. That's what the Third Amendment. This was one of those colonial era ones. It's the one that says no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. This is because the British used to force you to put four troops up in your house. They used to force citizens to have to bunk a bunch of soldiers. And the founders said, well, that's kind of screwed up. It's not really used much now because, like, nobody's trying to put soldiers in our houses. But it has been used in a couple of privacy cases. Griswold v. Connecticut was a case that determined the right to birth control. And that Justice Douglas in Griswold v. Connecticut used the Third Amendment in a logic train to try to say that there's a right to privacy. And the other way that marijuana prohibition is affecting the Third Amendment is there was a case, and it was in Oregon. This guy, Lopez was his name, who the cops followed him to a grow shop. And this is before it was legal, right? So the cops follow him to a grow shop. They see that he's buying a bunch of lights and ballasts and stuff. They follow him back to his home. After he parks his car in his driveway on his property, goes inside, goes to bed, cops go onto his property in the driveway, put a GPS on his car, and start tracking everywhere he's driving around to build the case against him. And so he took it to court and said, hey, doesn't that violate, you know, you can't just put stuff on me without a warrant. And the Ninth Circuit said, oh, yeah, they can. That's okay. You can put a GPS on a guy's car. Now, that still has yet to be challenged and should go to the Supreme Court pretty soon, but that's where we stand right now. Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizures shall not be violated, except we can take your pee. We can search your house if there's a pot smell and the sound of furtive movements. This was a recent case, I think it was the King case, where the cops had a warrant for an apartment building. Second floor, apartment on the right. They go up, second floor, apartment on the right. Nobody's there, but they can smell something from the apartment to the left. They smell weed coming from the apartment to the left. So the cops, yeah, do that cop knock, right? They knock on the door, and they hear, and so they bust the door down, and they find the guy with a bunch of weed. And the Supreme Court, and I think it was Scalia's decision on this, said that the smell of weed and the sound of someone moving around inside the room is enough to go ahead and bust down the door because they might be trying to destroy the evidence. Now, I get that with a bag of cocaine, right? You could flush that. These guys are going to be flushing plants? Like, what are they doing? Setting in a wood chipper? How are they supposed to destroy this stuff? It makes no sense. And, of course, Edward Snowden, you know, pointed out the fact that they're tracking all our email and mobile data. A lot of times in search of the war on drugs. The USA Patriot Act that was passed in the wake of 9/11 to go after terrorists, 9 out of 10 of the warrants in the Patriot Act for sneak and peek warrants are for drug cases, not terrorism. Yeah. They also say no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause. You have to have a warrant. You have to have probable cause, except in drug cases, the probable cause is I smell pot. All the probable cause. There's no smellometers. There's no way you can record whether that cop actually smelled something. It's just his word against yours, and guess who the judges believe. And also, these warrants, a lot of times they get the descriptions wrong, innocent people are terrorized, and their dogs are shot. There was a case, Catherine Johnston, 92-year-old woman in Atlanta, Georgia. Cops go on a warrant, they get the wrong number on the address, come through with the guns, come through with the armor on. She's 92. She's terrified. She's got a little pea shooter gun to defend herself. Fires once at the cops, goes over their head. They shot something like 72 times, killed her. And then after they had killed her, planted a bag of weed on her to try to make it look justified. Fifth Amendment. This is the one that says you can't have double jeopardy, right? You can't be tried twice for the same offense. Except they have this funny way of making one offense turn into multiple charges. Like, you sold someone some weed, okay, you sold weed, and you possessed weed, and you had a conspiracy to sell weed, and you had the intent to sell weed. It's like, that's four different charges for really the same thing, isn't it? It also says we cannot be compelled in a criminal case to be a witness against ourselves. We cannot self-incriminate, other than the fact they can take our blood, urine, hair, and saliva. Well, what's more self-incriminating than taking a piece of myself to prove that I committed a crime? And then not be deprived of life, liberty, or property without just compensation. Have y'all heard of civil asset forfeiture? Civil asset forfeiture is this thing where the state charges your property with a crime. Like, they literally have cases, United States of America versus $158,380. Like, the dollars themselves are the defendant, right? And civil asset forfeiture is a lower burden of proof. It's not innocent until proven guilty. It's guilty until proven innocent. You have to prove that your cash, like if you're traveling across the states and you got $20,000 on you, cops will take that $20,000, say that you're a drug dealer and that's drug money, and then you got to go to court and prove that it's not drug money. by hiring a lawyer with the $20,000 you don't have, right? How's that supposed to work? And that's exactly the way it works. They oftentimes like to seize $10,000, $20,000 because it costs you more to get it back than what you would get back, right? They don't go after the guys with $50 million because they got lawyers and they'll get that money back. Sixth Amendment, speedy trial. You have the right to a speedy trial, except Roger Christie out in Hawaii sat in jail for 4 years or 3 years waiting for a trial. Not so speedy. To be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation and confronted with the witnesses against you. If someone accuses you of a crime, you have the right to confront them in open court. How do I confront the drug dog? I got a drug dog who says I committed a crime. Woof, 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 arf, 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 woof. Your Honor, he's being uncooperative. All right, what do I say? I don't speak dog. I can't confront that witness. And you have the compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in your favor, subpoenas, and assistance of counsel, public defender. You have the right to a lawyer. Except your lawyer cannot use the words medical marijuana in court. Even in a medical marijuana state, if you're in federal court, the judge will find your attorney in contempt of court and remove him from the courtroom if he puts the word medical and marijuana in the same paragraph. Similarly, in every state except New Hampshire, defense attorneys cannot mention jury nullification. Do you know what that is? Jury nullification is the right that's existed since colonial times that says a juror may vote their conscience on the law itself. We could have videotape of this guy with 50 pounds of weed in his hand, selling it to a federal officer, videotape and 100 witnesses, and I could still say, Your Honor, not guilty. And I'd do that for you, man. I'd do that. Not guilty. And they can't punish you. They can't do a damn thing about it. So anytime you find yourself on jury duty in a marijuana case, no matter what the facts of the case, you can say not guilty. And it only takes one juror to hang that jury and set that person free. This has happened so much in possession cases in Montana now, they don't even bring them. They don't even file possession cases in Montana now because every time they bring a jury together, they say, well, this is a case for guy had 14 grams of weed. And all the jurors go, what? You wasted my work day for 14 grams of weed, what? So they can't even seat a jury because of jury nullification. Seventh Amendment, the right to sue. In suits of common law, you have the right to a trial by jury, but in an illegal state, how do you sue? My dealer shorted my bag. I'm taking him to court. You can't do that, right? You can now. In the Colorado, if someone shorts your bag from a legal store, you can sue them, but you can't do it in an illegal state. And another form of the double jeopardy here, no fact that's been tried can be retried. Like you went to court, like OJ right now could say, yep, I killed her, I'm guilty. They couldn't do a thing about it because once you've been found not guilty, that's it. They can't keep retrying you except with drugs. There was an interesting case in California where they were going after this guy who was a dispensary owner. And so what they did is they got the cops to get a fake ID. Now, it's not a fake ID because it's a real California ID. You know, the cops can get that. But it's not his real name on the ID, right? But the cop takes his fake ID, goes to a California doctor, gets a medical recommendation. Now, that's not the doctor's fault. The ID looks real to the doctor, and he believes the cop when he's lying about his back pain or whatever. So the cop takes his fake ID, his real doctor's recommendation, goes to the dispensary, buys some weed, and here come the cops in the raid because now there's been a federal trafficking offense. They took it to a federal court in California, and the defendant was found not guilty because these Californians are like, what are you doing? It's medical. This is ridiculous. So that prosecutor set up the same sting over again, got a different cop with another fake ID, with another recommendation, went back to the dispensary, had a raid, but this time managed to get a different jury in a different jurisdiction and got the guy convicted. So technically it wasn't being tried twice for the same crime. It was being tried twice for two completely identical crimes. And that's how they managed to get around the Seventh Amendment. Eighth Amendment, excessive bail shall not be required. I'm a criminal in the state of Utah. I was busted for the residue in a vapor pen in the state of Utah. 0.02 of a gram, or as I like to call it, out of marijuana. My fine was $1,200 for that. For 0.02 of a gram. Now, I don't know if that's excessive, but it sure felt excessive to me at the time. That was the bail. I'm sorry, $1,200 bail. And no 10% bail bondsman because I was from out of state. I had to come up with the $1,200 right there. nor excessive fines imposed. The federal fine for one marijuana seed is $250,000. Seedling or seed, $250,000 fine. Nor cruel or unusual punishments. Except I can tell you about three different stories of medical marijuana patients I know who were locked into a prison without their medical marijuana and died because of it. Seems kind of cruel. Now, in our little constitutional explanation, this is the clincher. The number one amendment that tells us we have a right to use cannabis is the Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I like to call this, we couldn't write them all down. Like you got life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, speech, religion, guns, but we couldn't write them all down. You have the right to breathe. You have the right to have sex. You have the right to drink water. They couldn't write them all down. And I gotta believe that a bunch of drunken revolutionary hemp farmers in an agrarian society that paid taxes with hemp would have thought that's a right. And it would have been such an obvious right, why would you write it down? It's like writing down the right to breathe air to these guys. They lived by hemp farming. That would be ludicrous to them. Also, in Article 8 of the Constitution, it lists out the powers that are vested in the federal government. Paragraph 3 is the Commerce Clause, and that's where there's two Supreme Court decisions that have screwed us. And I told you I'd get back to this one. Wickard v. Filburn. This was a thing in World War II. During World War II, there was rationing of wheat and sugar and meat, and there's just all these rationing programs for the war. This guy named Wickard was a wheat farmer. So he had his commercial wheat farm, and that was subject to the rationing limits. You could only grow so much wheat, sell so much wheat. But he also had his personal wheat farm. And he figured, well, this is my personal wheat farm. I can grow all the wheat I want in my personal wheat farm. Well, he got busted by the state, I think it was North Dakota, for exceeding his quota. Because they said, well, look, you only could have this many acres, and then you grew all those. But he said, but this is personal. I only have so many commercial acres, but this is personal. The Supreme Court ruled against Wickard because they said wheat is fungible. Fungible means you can't tell personal wheat from commercial wheat. And it's conceivable that Wickard might have overgrown his personal wheat and snuck a little over here under the commercial side for sale. No proof he ever did it, and he never did do it, but the judicial standard was, if it's possible, if he could maybe do it, it's illegal. And this was the first time the Commerce Clause was ratified as a way to ban something. Up to that point, again, they needed a constitutional amendment to ban alcohol, but by 1942, the justices found this nice little loophole in the Commerce Clause. This loophole came to bite us in the ass in 2003. California had passed medical marijuana by 1996. There was a brain tumor patient by the name of Angel Raich. She sued the federal government. At the time, it was, who's the guy before Gonzalez? Was John, not Walters. Ashcroft. So she had sued John Ashcroft, the attorney general, and it later was Gonzalez was the attorney general afterwards. But she sued the attorney general saying, look, you're using the Commerce Clause to ban pot. Commerce Clause is what regulates interstate commerce, the buying and selling of things across state lines. I'm a medical marijuana patient. I'm growing in California soil with California seeds, using California nutrients and California sun. I'm using it for medical purposes. It never crosses a state line. It's completely personal. There is no commerce. It's all California. And the federal government said, ah, Wickard v. Filburn, marijuana's fungible. It's possible, it's conceivable that you could grow some of your California medical marijuana and sell it in Nevada. And that's interstate. We don't have to prove you did. We don't have to prove you're gonna. But because it's possible, we can ban it. And that's why we're in the situation we are today, where the feds don't recognize medical marijuana. Crazy. 10th Amendment. We know the 10th Amendment. States' rights. The power is not delegated to the U.S. Constitution, nor prohibited to the states or reserved to the states or the people. Well, the Constitution does not delegate the power to regulate medical marijuana to the feds. It does not delegate the power to regulate subsistence farming to the feds. So to me, in a plain reading of the Constitution, understanding the historical background of the document, I believe we've got these rights. These rights to farming and medicine are the rights of the states and the people. And those cases, Wickard and Raich, are going to be like Dred Scott decision and Bush v. Gore. We're going to look back at those in history and regret we ever passed those. Few more civil rights that are impacted by marijuana prohibition. 13th Amendment, the amendment that freed the slaves. Except we've got pot criminals now that are working in prisons for 17 cents an hour for major corporations. It's not quite slave labor. We gave them 17 cents after all. 14th Amendment, Equal Protection Amendment, which says that the laws apply the same from state to state unless you're a medical marijuana patient. You can't travel from state to state. The 15th Amendment was the amendment that ratified voting rights for black folks, except because of the disproportionate enforcement of marijuana crimes, more black people are disenfranchised by the drug war than white people. In Florida, the felony possession level in Florida is 21 grams, or as I like to call it, a weekend, right? 21 grams, you get a felony. Because of this, 1/5 of all voting age black people in Florida cannot vote. 1/5, 1 out of 5. If they had been able to vote, George W. Bush never would have won Florida. It'd have been Al Gore. 16th Amendment, income tax. Income tax, well, that's how they're using 280E to go after the dispensaries with income tax. 19th Amendment, the women's right to vote. Well, just like black people lose their right to vote when they get felonies for drug convictions, so do women when they get felonies, and women in prison have increased 646% since 1980. Because a lot of times what happens is the woman is the girlfriend in the drug relationship, like she is the girlfriend of a drug dealer, and when he gets busted, he can snitch. He knows people to turn over on. He can get a deal. The girlfriend, she's got no one to snitch on. She ends up doing more time than the drug dealer boyfriend does. And then, of course, the 21st Amendment repealed prohibition. That's where we recognize intoxication in our Constitution. If we have the right to drink alcohol, we cannot not have the right to smoke weed. So be proud of being a marijuana legalizer. What else affects so many of our constitutional amendments? And I look at it like this. When they prohibit marijuana, they're stealing from us our American heritage. This is part of our history. Our whole country was founded on hemp. 1611 was the first hemp farm in America. 1850, Dr. O'Shaughnessy started bringing back medical marijuana info from India. By 1853, the New York Times was writing about hashish bars in big cities. By 1910, Louis Armstrong and Cab Calloway and Ella Fitzgerald, these musicians, are making marijuana a popular cultural item. So this has plenty of history behind it. And it speaks to all political stripes. Democrats, you can look at it as civil rights and racial justice and labor. Republicans, it's states' rights, individualism, small government. For liberals, it's personal choice and environmentalism. For conservatives, it's religious freedom and patriotism. There's not a reason for anybody to support this marijuana prohibition anymore. To wrap up, marijuana legalization is not done. This is still a continuing battle. Even here in Alaska, in my home state of Oregon, Colorado, and Washington, to the people out there, the mainstream that don't smoke pot, they think it's over. Oh, you legalized weed. All right, let's move on. And you and I both know that we've got plenty more battles still to fight. Misdemeanors and felonies still exist for certain marijuana violations. Why? There's no amount of beer I can possess and get cuffs slapped on me. There's no number of cartons of cigarettes I can have on me and get cuffs slapped on me. Employment, we can still be denied, discriminated against in the workplace because our pee turns up hot for weed. Parenting, courts can still award custody based on your marijuana use. Even in legal states, parents are still having to fight this. Medical, people can be denied organ transplants and pain medication if they turn positive for marijuana. I've known 3 people already who've died waiting for liver transplants because they were pot smokers and couldn't get on the list. Again, our Second Amendment rights, we don't have the right to guns and ammunition, concealed carry permits if we're busted for weed. We don't have the right to free travel. We can't take our weed across state lines. We have all those ad restrictions and speech restrictions I told you about. And then probably the one that's most vexing to me, our right to free assembly. This idea that we need to ban adult use venues. Now, you've got a great one here in Alaska at the potluck events. I was just there these past couple of nights. You can see my pictures there. That's the candy bar. They actually have a bar with candy for free. I'd like a shot of M&M's, please. You get a shot of M&M's. It's great. And I sit there, and it's all peaceful and fun and friendly, and I think, man, I played music in bars for 15 years. I'd never seen a place as friendly and laid back as a pot lounge. Why are we so afraid of this thing? And furthermore, we're not even asking for these things to be like regular bars. I mean, so far they've been private. They've been bring your own bud. They've been all volunteer. We've tried everything to try to get these things through, but you're really lucky here in Alaska so far because you're the only one of the four states that have operating pot lounges at this point. In Washington State last year, they felonized pot clubs. You run a bar or a club that even incidentally allows marijuana smoking, that's a Class C felony. In Oregon, my home state, they added cannabis smoke and cannabis vapor to our Clean Air Act. You cannot vaporize or smoke pot indoors. Now, it's weird because the Clean Air Act was based on secondhand tobacco smoke, which has been shown to be harmful, but secondhand cannabis smoke has not been shown to be harmful. How do you just attach that to that law? And our Clean Air Act allows exemptions for cigar bars and smoke shops that have adequate ventilation. So we made a law because tobacco smoke was bad. We used it to ban cannabis smoke, but we'll give an exemption to tobacco smoke. The hypocrisy and the bigotry couldn't be more clear. And Denver Normal right now is fighting to legalize pot lounges in the city of Denver with an initiative there. So marijuana prohibition has been completely un-American. It contravenes our natural rights. It's unconstitutional as hell. I hope I maybe gave you a little bit of insight into that to understand that this is a civil rights fight. We have nothing to be ashamed of. Sometimes they denigrate us as, oh, you guys are fighting to get high. No, we're already getting high. Been getting high for years. No, we're fighting for civil liberties. We're fighting for equal rights. We want to be treated with the same rights, responsibilities, and respect as the average beer drinker. I'm not stopping until we get there. Thank you, everybody. I'm Radical Russ Belville from CannabisRadio.com. You can check out my show on CannabisRadio.com, iTunes, iHeartRadio, and, of course, Cannabis Radio. My booth is 103 across the way if you want to talk or grab a card, and we'll get the next speaker up here as soon as possible. Thanks for your attention.